My name is Tom Evans. I'm a geologist with the Wisconsin Geological Natural History Survey, and I work a lot with mining issues in the state of Wisconsin. And these are very controversial issues in Wisconsin. A lot of anger on the side of some parties involved in the issue. Other parties tend to take a kind of standoffish view, like the governmental entities involved try to stay out of the fray as much as they can and let the public hassle over certain issues and one thing or another. It's always been a kind of a unsettling process to me in a way, because it seems like there's so much anger oftentimes involved and distress. And so this is really this what I hope will be a discussion, because I certainly know I'm not going to be any kind of have any last words on this, but I just wanted to explore the ways in which we make decisions about basically technical issues. And the way we do this about technical issues in many cases in a non-technical sense, in other words, in society, when we make decisions about technical issues in society, we often are using the same processes that we use to make other kinds of issues in society. And so those processes are the same. But my thinking is that technical issues sometimes bring different, perhaps some different dynamics into that process. And so I've sort of subtitled this thing, Can We Find Community in the Midst of Controversy? Some of these issues can be extremely controversial. But let me just give some definitions, and then we have a common base to start from. When I'm talking about a technical decision, it's usually a decision that's based on some kind of fact. It might be an issue of science, it might be an issue of technology, it might be an issue of engineering, but usually it's based on some kind of fact. I remember being in a meeting once, and a comment came up about, but what are the facts involved in this? You know, I mean, the facts are this, A, B, and C. Somebody in the back of the room said, whose facts? And I remember being almost dumbfounded by the comment, because as a scientist, the facts don't belong to anybody, you know. They're facts. They stand in isolation. But what the person was raising was that I think that facts, there are so many facts out there. We choose facts. We choose an assemblage of facts about an issue that kind of maybe furthers our particular perspective on it. And it showed me that these science issues aren't always necessarily black and white, yes and no, right or wrong. Can we think of some examples that might be science kinds of issues that we do in a non-technical world, and using these processes we'll talk about in a minute, that might be controversial? Let me throw out an example to show you the kind of thing I'm thinking about. When we cite, do you know what a lulu is?
What?
A lulu, L-U-L-U, is a locally unacceptable land use. A lulu. So it's a wonderful acronym that captures this thing.
Kind of like a NIMBY.
What?
Kind of like a NIMBY?
It creates, I mean, NIMBYisms are associated with lulus. This is going to be a kind of a weird conversation if we stay in acronym.
And what is it? Locally
unacceptable land uses. Can you think of any that might be locally unacceptable land.
Clear cutting of timber in the north.
Clear cutting of timber might be one. A what?
Garbage dump, landfill.
Garbage dump, landfill.
Incinerator.
Sure.
Their waste disposal.
Right. Great example. A mine. An adult bookstore in certain areas might be a locally unacceptable land use. But a lot of prisons is another example, but it's kind of interesting in Wisconsin. Prisons are becoming okay because
the art community rallied around the cause to get. In fact, they bought the land and gave it to the state so they would have a prison in our area.
So you would have a prison.
So we would have a prison.
Right. So you would have the economic development that the prison would bring.
The growth industry.
Various forms of halfway houses.
Right. Well, I have dealt a lot with mining issues, so that's another area of technical activity which raises controversy, is when we try to regulate certain kinds of activities like metal mining. So some of my examples will be from that, but there are many examples out here of things that we could be talking about. So that's what I'm talking about. When I talk about the non-technical world, I guess what I mean by that is that we're talking about society and relationships that are outside the realm of science and technology. I'm not talking about two scientists disagreeing over some observation of some relationship in science. I'm not talking about a debate over the makeup of the intercosmic gas between two interstellar bodies or something like that, how much of that is hydrogen and how much of that might be something else. I'm not talking about where basically scientific controversies. I'm talking about controversies that involve science but are in the public arena, in the social arena. So we're not talking about scientific debate so much here. As I am talking about things which involve different sets of values, and whether those values are political values or social values, but they engage people at levels in which are touching their particular values. And it's interesting because it's at that level that I think the ways in which we make decisions tends to have problems. There are times when facts are in dispute, but generally it's when you have incomplete facts or you're selecting facts to present a particular viewpoint. Generally, the facts themselves are not so much in dispute. Let's see if I can give you an example. There's a mining proposal in Wisconsin in which there is a tailings management area, and in this tailings management area will be 22 million tons of sulfide-bearing waste. And it is accepted that tailings management area will leak. It's understood that it's impossible to build a facility that is totally encapsulated. That at some point in time, it will leak. Okay. Both sides agree on this issue. The question becomes, you know, how much leakage will there be? What will happen to that leakage? What will be the nature of that leakage? Okay, that's where we'll be in dispute. But the fact that it will leak is not a question. The question becomes how much. But then the question becomes, what do you do about it? Can we accept that kind of thing? And how do we make a decision about whether or not to accept that? And we've done that through the political process. We have accepted that through the political process because we've seen that while it may leak, leaking is not a problem. But a violation of an environmental standard becomes a problem. So as long as it does not violate a particular environmental standard, it does not matter if it leaks. Now, I'm simplifying.
You can do something to it to you know, to make the leaking not as big. You can catch it, you can neutralize it, you can send it somewhere else.
Right. And of course, you design your facility in such a way to minimize the leakage by catching it and then treating that. But even with all these fail-safes, there's a recognition that there will be something that will pass. Well, you can't make anything 100%. Okay, so I'm going to talk about what are styles of government decision-making. And this is just out of my experience, okay? And you may think of others, and there are others, and that's what but I want to put these on the board and kind of have these, and then we'll talk about others that might be. And we'll talk about these a little bit. But I think in many of these areas, there are three basics, there are three styles that I'm aware of. One is simply a legislative style, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. And another is what I call an executive style, or an agency style of decision making. And then I'll talk about a consensus style. And I'll give some examples of where I've seen them. I know that there are others, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit with you all, what others might be good and that we could use. Well, let's think about the legislative style, for example. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the process that we use to adopt laws. Okay. We have deliberative bodies, House of Representatives and the Senate, or the Assembly in Wisconsin, it's the Assembly and the Senate, and you have legislators, and they propose laws, and they debate the laws, and the laws go to committees, and the committees debate the laws, and the committees report the laws out, and they modify them perhaps, and they go to the floor, and they're debated, and they're amended, and eventually it goes to some executive, perhaps a governor, and it's signed or it's vetoed, and the veto is overridden if it's vetoed, or it's not overridden, and the process, the legislative process. What might be good about that process, can you think? What might be a good part of that process? What's good about it?
Theoretically, we all have input.
Right. It has a certain element of democracy associated with it, which we think is good.
They're supposed to be professional decision makers.
You're giving it to professional decision makers?
Well, with our input, but they are supposed to be professional decision makers.
Representatives in the true sense of the word.
Right.
Now, let me ask you, though, when you say...
I'm saying that's the good. I can see a lot
right,
of that.
All right, no. let me just come back. I mean, when I think of our legislators, and I'll bet you it's not too different anywhere else, any other state, then. But when I think of our state legislators, I don't think of professionalism too much. Now, I could be really wrong.
Well, they're professional legislators. They're not always doing the professional something. Mm-hmm. They're lawyers.
I mean, they are professional lawmakers, yes. Most of them are lawyers.
Yeah, they are professional. But how about their behavior?
They all know all their faults.
They're political. They're essentially professional.
Oh. Well, sometimes they get involve in some of the weirdest issues.
I know. Only looking at the good potential, the idealized state of what they are. Yeah.
It's democratic.
Yeah. I mean, they are trained.
Those are people we've selected to make these decisions. So there are professional decision makers and lawmakers in that sense. We've elected them to that.
Well, it's a place for debate, or you know, usually there's input from both sides.
Right. There's an atmosphere
of opinions, so there's a debate and conversation back and forth about the issue.
They're accountable. Mm-hmm. theoretically, they're accountable. They're involved in debate, and they reach a decision. Those are good points. How about some bad points?
Well, I have one that could be either good or bad. That's that it tends to be self-correcting. So you never go very far in my direction. You just kind of weave back and forth like this on many issues.
It's interesting.
Incrementalism to throw in a few more.
Exactly. How many issues does a legislator have to deal with?
Uh-huh. Well, they're always worried about re-election. So very few of them are willing to go out on any sort of a limb.
Yeah, that's true.
That's both good. If you've made a wrong decision, you know, in your opinion, then it'll be corrected if you work hard enough. But, you know, if you've worked hard for it to go this way, you know, and it's going that way, and somebody, you know, then the other side rallies and yells loud enough, and then it goes back the way you don't like, so.
Yeah.
And then that's characteristic of it.
And unfortunately, our lobbying system is such that money speaks a great deal, often.
How does money speak in that sense?
Well, for example, in Washington State, Boeing, you know, has several lobbyists, and they pay a lot of money for their interests to be in the legislature, to lobby the legislators to make decisions that are an advantage for example, Boeing.
Okay, I want to distinguish something on lobbying, though, just for the sake of argument. I want to be sure that we separate lobbying in the sense of providing information about a special interest from contribution, from paying money.
Often hard to make that.
It is sometimes hard to make that decision. But to me, there's a good side of lobbying and there's a bad side of lobbying. And I don't know if that's an artificial distinction or not, but, and like you say, sometimes you can't make that distinction because it's, but it's interesting to me that here we have these legislators who we've elected to make decisions, and they're bombarded with all these decisions. My God, of course they need information. They want information. And I know that legislators develop relationships with lobbyists over time because they begin to trust a lobbyist's information. Now, again, I understand that there's a relationship sometimes between lobbying, presenting a point of view, and also contributing money. They are so sensitive to re-election, oftentimes. You know, our legislators are re-elected every 2 years in our assembly. I suppose that's not too different. One house of our senators are re-elected every 4 years, I guess it is, every 4 years. So. There's always that thinking about that election out there, and so that the need for money to run for election is always there. But so lobbyists provide a service in some case, you know, as well as so I hate to be too down on it. But I'm always amazed at the breadth of issues that legislators are faced with. And I've said this myself, boy, that is the stupidest person I have ever met. and I deal with legislators every once in a while, and I'm sure they think the same about me. But I mean, I'm just saying that, you know, wow, they can seem so ignorant sometimes. But then you gotta back off and say, you know, your issue is not the only one that they're dealing with that day. They may have 10 or 12 of those issues that they're dealing with that day, and they're concerned about re-election and stuff. And so they've got a lot of things going on in their minds. What might, if I'm on this executive or agency style? What I'm thinking about here is that there is a process, as you probably are aware, that when you pass a law, the law generally will mandate that there be administrative rules developed. And that's because in laws, you don't necessarily get down to the nitty-gritty of how you're going to do certain things. This is particularly in a technical area. You don't really get down to the nitty-gritty of how you're going to do it. You write an administrative rule. So you say to a state agency, okay, this law mandates that you write administrative rules for mining, for metal mining. Okay, so you go to the state agency then that's charged with this, and then they have to develop the administrative rules. The administrative rules have the force of law. Once they're adopted, they're just as much a law as the statutes are. But you don't want your legislators sitting there debating whether the standard for arsenic in groundwater should be 10 parts per billion or 20 parts per billion or 5 parts per billion.
Because they don't know the science.
They don't know the science. And so you give it to an agency who theoretically has expertise. And then they have a way of making a decision about that. And they can say, okay, well, we know based on our looking at the literature that 10 parts per billion makes sense, ties in with the national standards, et cetera, et cetera. We'll protect public health, safety, and welfare, and all that kind of stuff. So what would be a good point about the executive style of decision making? Now, there's a whole body of decisions that they make. Those are the administrative rules. So what would be a good point about it?
It's rational instead of political. It is done, I would say that is done by professionals.
Okay.
Quasi-professionals. And that sometimes people in the agencies don't have all that much expertise, say in mining or in land use. They have somewhat more of a political background. They kind of straddle political and professional.
And I'm really talking about those staff people. Because I know that in agencies at the very, very top, those are almost always appointed positions. And Governor Thompson in our state has been criticized for some of his upper-level agency appointments being a bunch of political cronies kind of thing. But I know that down at the agency, at the staff level in the agency, those people tend to be more career people.
They're more career-oriented, but I think they are what I call instant experts. Suddenly you're having to write the administrative rules on an area that you're not really familiar with, and you bone up real fast.
Well, that's true. That can happen. That they get called into an area which they really don't have the background that they need.
Sometimes the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing too. It passes out and thins out, and you get, at least in education in our state, lots of times you get two. This comes down and there are conflicting things in the administrative law, whatever.
Yeah, it's interesting. You find most of the conflict in the statutes. We recently passed a law in Wisconsin to regulate non-metallic mining, and called a group together to draft an administrative rule to play that out, and they couldn't do it. There are too many inherent conflicts in the statutes that just were not, you weren't so obvious until you try to sit down and try to figure out how you were going to do it. Then when you figured out how you're going to do it, you find out you couldn't do it. You couldn't be consistent. And so what they did there was to go back and draft an administrative rule first, and then go back and try to fix the legislation to mandate the rule. Now they had to get kind of blessing, if you will, from the legislators that were really invested in the issue. I mean, the legislators had to be educated to understand that what they had attempted to do was just not going to play out very good. But that gets us into another issue of consensus, but go ahead.
Usually in Washington State, they're called WACs, Washington Administrative Codes. There's usually also a public process involved in that. In other words, the codes are written, and then there's hearings and different things. I know
exactly.
I work in the mental health field, and that's usually what happens.
Exactly right.
There's comment periods, and you might have two or three public hearings before their time.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's not something that's done in secret.
Right.
It's got a public process associated with it. Another thing I like about the process, about the executive or agency style, is that it tends to be a little, it tends not to be directly influenced by political pressure. Those people tend to be a little insulated from political pressure. That's not always 100% across the board, but they tend not to get caught up into the politics of an issue. What might be some bad points about it?
They can be perhaps more easily manipulated because they're not out in the forefront. They don't have everyone attacking at once. Someone can more subtly go in and manipulate how they do things. I'd like to think of an example, but I guess in general would say that an agency can find its funding coming from a certain direction, perhaps, and of course that may slant the results of their studies.
The funding issue is an interesting one. In Wisconsin, there is a fund that's created from mining permit fees, and that part of that funding goes to support the activity of the mining regulators. Now, to me, there's a potential there for conflict, but we have so little metal mining in Wisconsin, there's not much conflict, but if you had a really robust mining industry, there would be potential, I think, for conflict there. Do you think the administrative rule process is as accessible to the public as, and why not? You just talked about public hearings and...
Well, sometimes the certain constituents get that information, not everybody gets that information. I mean, it may be publicly announced or whatever, but it's not something, it's not as open a process, or it's not as out in the public as the legislative process.
It tends to get a little more specialized process. I mean, you got to kind of be in the game a little bit to know about that. Then legislators tend to be more, legislatures, not the people, but the process tends to be more open to news reporters coming around and telling you when that thing's in session and what the issues are, and there seems to be better coverage. It's difficult for a reporter to cover an administrative rule development because oftentimes it's a little too specialized for them and they don't quite capture it. A third process, our style of decision making is consensus, and we use this in Wisconsin when we developed the metallic mining framework. It was so contentious when this was going on. People were so angry at each other, and companies were saying, "Well, we're going to leave Wisconsin. We're going to, you know, you won't have a job. You're going to leave. We don't, you know, we just can't afford to work here." And people were saying, "Oh, gosh, we don't want to lose any. We don't want to lose that. But yet, we don't want to lose the environment either." And so, the big debate going on as to how to come up with a set of laws that would work. And so they went through a process called consensus. And this is basically, in the simplest form, is where you bring all the stakeholders together. Okay, you bring all the stakeholders together, quote unquote, around the table, and try to hash out together something that'll work, that everybody can kind of agree to. And you'll see this, you may have, I don't know whether in your states you see this, they'll be talking about agreed to legislation. In other words, where there has been some process in which all the vested interests have been brought into the process and allowed to comment and allowed to debate and allowed to get at the issues. And then they've come up with some product called a piece of agreed to legislation. And I'm just wondering, how about some good points about that process? Are there good points of that process?
It's certainly good with small groups. To be really hard with a big group, though.
Well, okay. What do we mean by a big group?
Anything bigger than 10.
Okay. And you're talking about the group that's actually sitting down and discussing the issue.
Yeah,
they may represent big constituencies, okay? But you're talking about the actual getting together and discussing the different points of view. They may represent big points of view, but they may just be one or two people doing that around a particular table.
And with who you get together, like if it's a mining issue, so you got the mining companies, and you get, so who do you get to talk to the miners? So an environmental group or just some citizens that live nearby?
Right.
And who makes up the group?
That is exactly one of the critical questions about consensus. Ideally, you get all the vested interest at the table. If you have all the vested interests at the table, then theoretically you're having all the viewpoints represented. What guarantees you that you're going to get all the vested interests at the table? Okay. Well, generally you'll get most of them on issues. If it's a true consensus process, you'll generally get most of them there. Now my question would be asking for a negative aspect of this. I mean, it sounds great. You get everybody together and they all have their points of view, they raise their points of view, but there are a couple problems with it.
You can be very set in your own way, you can't listen to anything.
Yeah, you don't get to consensus.
Right. You can be in positions where you can't compromise. I mean, obviously you have to be willing to compromise to some degree on certain issues. And there may be some issues you can't compromise on. For example, if we're debating mining regulation, the mining company, and part of the debate might be taxes or something, the mining company can't compromise to the point where they give all their money to somebody else. I mean, they have to be in business to make a profit. I mean, that's ultimately what they have to do. If you're an environmental group, you can't compromise with environmental protection. Ultimately, you can't compromise on that. I mean, that's basically undermining your whole point in being there. But oftentimes, these viewpoints have gray areas that you can adjust within those gray areas. But what about the ability to participate in a consensus process? Is it equal around that table? What might be some differences among the participants at that table?
And the negotiating abilities?
Negotiate. Who they are. I'll tell you, this is a process that is incredibly personality dependent. You can bring the same elements to the table on an issue. But if you have different people at that table, you'll come out with a different result. I can guarantee you. So that's one thing.
Sure. You have the neighbors. Let's say it's a very poor neighborhood, whatever, poor people who have not much education or financial resources to gather around the experts and the big mining companies that have put their mine next to this rural small town.
Right.
And they don't have the where for all to. They can say, we don't want it here, but they can't say why.
Right. So what's the difference between those two parties? Money? It could be different.
Knowledge
could emotion. Be different. The what?
Emotion.
The emotion could be very different. Now, that can work in favor of the lesser participant. Let's use the word lesser for the sake of argument. The lesser participant, and they may have more emotion than the bigger or the greater participant sometimes. But emotion could be different. Their commitment to the process could be different in that sense. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt. That's right.
I think sometimes I know the process where I've seen, say, three or four different representations or perspectives in a consensus process. What I found is it really gets sabotaged in a sense when one, like for example in our county, the county has the final decision making. And you think that a decision has been made or consensus has been decided on within a group process, and then another decision is made after that meeting is over with. And that has really been, I think, a destructive know, rather than, I think the process would work better if people just are able to state at the time of the meeting what their stand is, or what their, or what the limitations are, or what the constraints are.
What I talked about that very issue with a legislator who was involved in a mining issue in Wisconsin, and she raised that point, saying, you know, it doesn't matter what's going on in consensus, it ultimately has to come back to me. Mm-hmm. And it's got to satisfy me that we're doing this. But she had made a commitment to the consensus process. She more or less said, I can't debate these issues. I don't have time to debate these issues. I don't have the knowledge to debate these issues. And she had to develop a certain amount of trust in the principal people involved in the consensus process, that they were not going to be, you know, that she had to be confident that there was enough counterbalance around that table. The mining interests would be there, the environmental interests would be there, and that they were equivalent enough. You know, that she was confident that what they would come out with, she wouldn't have to sit there and just go through it line by line and educate herself all over again and everything. She was willing to accept that. It became, she had to understand that the process would produce something that would be agreed to, and that she would buy into it.
Sometimes one of those consensus meetings can be loaded one way or the other. Yeah. Somebody brings enough people in to load the meeting, and that, I've been in one where that happened and felt like a nothing sitting there while it was overloaded with all people on the other side.
It's real critical to who's involved in that process and what they bring to that table. Because you're not going to get necessarily equality of money or information or power around that table. However, you can do things to ensure that, or to address some of that. And I'll talk about a process which has been used in Canada, which addresses it a little bit. One of the things about agreed-to legislation is that it'll often pass like 90-2. Or, I mean, you know, and you always wonder about whether those 90 people voting for it read it. You know, it always bothers you that you're almost sure that they didn't read it. But it had the label of agreed-to on it. So who's at that table is critical. Do they bring equal information? Do they have equal access to information and money around that table? Here's another one. If you have agents, sometimes you have agencies participating in consensus. They're working to try to get agreement about a, say, an administrative rule. This is being used at the federal level, consensus process, to try to develop administrative rule. But agencies can't compromise certain points. You can't compromise the law, so sometimes you can't always be able to move certain directions. So sometimes, while a mining company has a full field to compromise in, or an environmental group the full field to compromise into a certain point, agencies oftentimes are blocked off by the law. The law won't let them get beyond a certain point. There is a style that's used in Canada, which I learned about, called a board of inquiry. I don't know if you any have heard about boards of inquiries, but they were debating uranium mining in British Columbia back about 15 years ago. So they created a royal commission or board of inquiry. And this was a mandated process by the government. The government funded it. They created a commission, had three commissioners on it. They had a staff that was hired. And what they did was to go out and try to collect all the information they could collect about the issue of uranium mining. So information availability would not be a question. Everybody who wanted to participate in the inquiry would have equal access to that information. It was funded by the government. participants in the process were identified by this commission. Those who were going to participate had to be identified by the commission as having a legitimate interest. I mean, you wouldn't want to be talking about uranium mining and one of the participants is worried about UFOs or something like that, which have nothing to do with uranium mining, but they just wanted to be there. Now, that's an extreme example, but the point is, because participant funding would be paid for by the government. So the government had a control over, in a sense, who could participate, because they could choose not to support certain people. They felt that their interests were too far afield. But it was an independent body making that decision. It wasn't somebody with a vested interest making that decision. But boards of inquiries have been used to debate very complex issues in Canada. And I just mentioned this as an aside before we go on to something else, that there are ways of dealing with the issue of information availability and money differences if the government will sanction a process and sanction it by giving it support and a role in the whole process. Ultimately, whatever is decided has to come back into the legislative process. So it's we always have that.
Question on that. Who picks the board?
What?
Who picks the board?
Generally picked by an independent group such as, say, it would be our National Research Council, something of that nature. In other words, a group that is recognized independently of government, but recognized for their scientific contributions, and then this sort of council has its own staff, and then they can recognize who might be expert in this particular area, who might have experience in a particular area, and pick a commission. Usually, it's done independently of any kind of direct governmental purpose. Well, the government would be doing the picking, but I mean, they're not picking it because of political views or contributions that they've made to the government, but rather to their scientific reputation. Well, this is all very well and good, and perhaps interesting. I don't know, but there are some things about the process about this that this whole issue of making these decisions that bothers me, and I just want to raise these issues with you to see what you think. How in this process that we're using, are these processes that we're using, what do we do when we have conflicting or totally incompatible worldviews or value systems? What about Native Americans participating in the process related? Let's talk about, say, a mining project in Wisconsin or someplace. There may be some Native American lands nearby, may not be directly where the mine is going to be, but do we do anything about those different worldviews? This is a Western process. This is a European process. It is based, legislative processes and administrative agencies are Western constructions. Okay, and that's what our law is based on. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just simply saying it's very Western. There is law, there are rules, there are processes that we use to select them. And that comes out of issues like property rights. We recognize property rights. The land, within certain limits, you're going to be able to do pretty much what you want to do with that land. And there's a whole body of law constraining how you use that land a little bit, built around the premise of you can use your land the way you want as long as it doesn't interfere with somebody else's use of their land. We have the private property right, which is fundamental in Western law, English common law, fundamental in our country. But what about, say, groups that are affected by these decisions that don't have those particular views? What about Native American groups? How do we accommodate that particular view? We don't? Is there a way? This is an area where I really, really struggle, because I don't know an answer here. What do we say? What do we do? Let me ask this. Are they excluded from the process? No. Probably not excluded. From a legalistic point of view, they're not excluded from the process. Are they excluded from the process in any other sense?
Well, I would think that they would probably say yes, they are. Just from my experience of, working with other people, minorities who have different, frames of reference for different culture. But I think it's really hard because I don't think that we understand, it's so hard to understand where really those people are coming from, unless you enmesh yourself or immerse yourself, I should say. And I think there's issues all the time that come up. I know in Washington there was a deal about shellfish allocation and my family has waterfront property, and it started out like those people could walk across our property to get to the shellfish and then just take their right. share of the shellfish. Well, of course, then you get concerned about, are they going to deplete all the shellfish?
Yeah, right.
Right. Why can they walk across my property, what gives them the right to walk across my property to get to that shellfish?
Exactly right.
It seems related to a question that's kind of been in the back of my mind while you were talking. Where did our right to tell people, we've been talking about mining, whether or not they can dig a mine come from? What's the ultimate root here?
Well, minerals are a part of those bundle of rights that go with property.
Mm-hmm.
You can sometimes separate, pull that stick out of that bundle of rights, using that image, and
we
separate
have to go
it out.
All the way back to what gave people the right to own property. How do we determine that? And were the groups that now feel excluded included in that process at that time? Probably not,
no.
From my knowledge.
Well, I think the concept of private property goes back a fairly long distance, but in terms of Great Britain, boy, you're really going to take me back into world history. But I'm going to say it's going to be back in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries kind of context where you move from feudal lords, which had fiefdoms, and then you had serfs. And they worked, they had homes, and they were fine as long as they were in serving the Lord. They were protected by the Lord. The Lord protected them from marauding in terms of crime and that kind of thing. But eventually there was a movement to actually give them some sense of ownership of that kingdom, but it was not all public or crown lands. Now,
but that we brought that system over to this new land as we saw it, totally unowned land, and imposed it.
Right.
So we came to this vacant.
And we created a problem.
We came to this vacant land.
You can give it a go.
Not recognizing there were Native Americans here, and the government bought or traded or claimed land, and then they started a process of dividing it up in. Giving it away or letting it, but gave it to railroads for the development of the, they gave them the land so they get minerals and forests and things, or they gave it to homesteading. And they sold it. The government disposed of land by all of those methods.
We have what's considered a more formal approach to it, but the Native Americans owned land too. They fought a lot over the land that they owned and the properties that they owned on that land. I mean, they didn't, I mean, it's a very different way of looking at it, but there were money wars between Indians fighting over who owned what. It's just we didn't have the paperwork.
A territory yeah. concept.
I mean, maybe there wasn't, you know,
deeds
and laid out lines and all these types of things, but people knew whose
land
it was.
Recognized that the Chippewas owned these are the people of this area, and the, whoever the Sioux were there, the people of this land.
So it sounds like we're going back totally, whichever path you take, to Native Americans or European culture, that might is right is what established land use or land ownership.
Often. Except for when you created democracies, which supposedly gave people without might the right to land.
Right. And I think probably one of the reasons we developed some of the concepts of property that we have is to avoid or to regulate the disposition of land and the use of land in a way which is more orderly. Mm-hmm. And it's not based necessarily on might is right. So you create a process of rights that are there legalistically, not necessarily based on your ability to defend those rights physically. But this, we're doing this on land which in large part has been taken away from Aboriginal groups. It's not so much that we're a stronger necessarily, we are, in a sense, using the image of different tribes, a stronger tribe and therefore able to have pushed them off land. We now have codified that to the nth degree with our laws and property rules and one thing or another. And but we can't get too, I really don't think we can get too bogged down in that. Because that's just the way it is. But the question is, I think, do groups which have totally different views of the world have a role to play in all these processes, and is there a way to accommodate that particular perspective? It's a struggle to me because there is that part of me that let's say that Christian part of me that says we need to accommodate all those views if we can. We need to accommodate the different world views when we make decisions. I wish our process could recognize the sense of Mother Earth that Native American groups often espouse. There is the other part of me, however, which is more rationalistic, more scientific, which says, hey, that's the way it is. For whether it should be or not is beyond debate. It is our country, and the history is the history, and this is the way the laws are, and so what can we do? So if I have that point of view, can I take that point of view and apply it in a Christian way? Can I make sure that all groups, regardless of their worldview, let's say, have access to the process? I mean, I've got the process, it's my process, but can I make sure that everybody has access to that process? That I think is one key, is access to the process. And what do we mean by access? There's gotta be, let's go back to something that you said, Carl, there's gotta be money. They got to be able to play. They got to have information. They got to know what the rules are, and they got to know what the issues are and stuff. And one of my jobs in Wisconsin is to make sure that people have information, have as much information as possible about an issue, about these issues. And it theoretically doesn't make any difference to me who I give that information to or how they're going to use it. I mean, the information is everybody's information. So that's one part of access, is having information. I used to worry a lot more about, for example, Native American groups not having the financial capability to participate. I worry less about that now because the Native American groups, at least in my part of the world, are generally well-financed now because of changes in their social structure. And casinos have made a big impact. I mean, they've made a big impact. Well, I know it's not my choice of how to raise money, but that's made a big impact in the Native American communities in Wisconsin. But I don't know how that plays out in some of the Western Native American communities. I don't know what the story is. I just simply don't know. I mean, in Washington, do you have Indian casinos?
Yeah.
It's
more day by day.
This is the current building that just happened. It's being every tribe. We're a small county, have some very small tribes, you know, maybe an island here, just you know, not even live on their reservation, and now they have a casino.
Yeah.
And now the other tribe in the county wants to have a casino. There's only 40,000 people in the whole county.
Yeah.
Ironically, they make a lot of money at the 4th of July by selling fireworks.
Yeah. But you know,
but it's still little kind
of. I was talking with somebody about this issue in a food line, I guess it was. And I have a hard time being upset about it though. I mean, again, it's not my way of making money. I don't go to casinos and spend my money that way. Or if I made the choice to do that, that's perfectly fine. I mean, I could make a choice to do that and say I'm going to spend $100 on entertainment and define entertainment to be gambling. I mean, I think that you could make that decision. I don't have any problem with people going to casinos. It's just a recreational choice I don't make. I know in Wisconsin it's made a very positive impact because the Native American, they can do more about healthcare locally. They can do more about their own educational structures. It's caused in certain communities some real conflicts because you're putting money in the midst of communities in which there are long festering animosities between different groups within that, which I wouldn't have any knowledge about. You know, one part of the tribe hating the other part of the tribe, but yeah.
I mean, I feel like you do about casinos in general, though. I think that it sure would be nice if there was another way. It's not a proud way to make money. I don't believe for the American Indians. It's more proud than selling drugs or something like that. But it's not like they're. To me, it doesn't seem like a proud way to make money. That's compounded by the fact that they're taking money from the white community to build the Indian population's wealth. Seems to be a sort of like a conflict or a get back type of attitude, and it would be much nicer if they were developing a wealth. Developing a resource, perhaps, of course, yeah. Then you run into comfortable with, are they going to open a mine? Plus, it has, gambling and all that has such a long history of being related to crime and sin and all of that. But I see it everywhere. I come from Maryland, and I came out here. I've been traveling around a little bit before I came here. And, I see billboards everywhere for casinos here, and it was quite a shock to see that.
Yeah.
It's better than the image I had before of Native Americans living in trailers with pickup trucks living off welfare checks.
I don't think that it's changed that too much.
No.
To be really
just a few people got really rich. Yeah.
You think because it's not being shared?
No, I mean, in Tulalip here up north of Seattle, they just got busted for you know, giving money from the charity gambling tables to their individual, to individual people within the tribe.
Oh, and,
the people who didn't need it.
Yeah, the people who didn't need it, and, you know, they got caught at doing it, but, you know, and I'm not pro or con for that issue, you know, I think that, you know, how are we all to know how deep the pain or shame goes for those people back to what happened, you know, so many, you know, hundred, 200 years ago.
So he puts his money with the soul.
No, I don't think money's going to solve the issues with Native Americans. I mean, I think it might help, as you say, with some of the conversations that you're talking about. But
I think money helps solve certain problems. I really do.
Help in Alaska.
When they've got access to money in a certain way, and but that doesn't guarantee that that money is going to be used in ways which are going to address those issues and stuff like that.
I mean, the whole thing with the HUD money for housing. I mean, yeah. You know, two of the people within the Tulalip tribe took the money, and husband and wife, and built this huge house. Well, you know. The locals are still waiting for their better housing. They're still living in places that have no power. I've been in some of those places. I know what it's like.
And it's finally admitted that they've screwed up.
Yeah.
They've restructured. They said, man, there was...
Yeah, I was going to say that was also a screw up at the agency level,
right.
In that it wasn't even illegal. It may have been immoral what they did, but it was not illegal.
Right.
Well, we seem to have touched a Washington issue here.
Yeah. No, actually, it wasn't just a Washington issue.
Oh.
It was across the country.
Oh, yeah.
But it was in the paper.
Yeah.
It was in the
okay.
paper.
Interesting.
And the other thing was the casino money, like our local casino in our little town. They hired a big casino outfit of white casino
sure.
operator people to come and build this casino.
Right.
And I don't know exactly what the cut is, but I have a hunch that the developers of this, the builders, and the get a good part of it.
Oh yeah, I'm
we say
I'm
humanity
sure.
is humanity, no matter where it is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when they talk in our little base from our town with that casino there, I mean, it says, okay, the police department's going to get $5,000 extra this month for police. You know, so there's these little token dribbles of money to the county because of the extra traffic, you know, and the school.
Yeah.
It may be a little bit. It's sort of like
right.
joke.
As much as the tribe is, rather than individuals in a tribe, get the money though, they're more likely to put it into community services
mm-hmm.
than they are
yeah,
into
so there's
individual
that.
Things.
Yeah.
They put it into health service
yeah.
or education
mm-hmm.
or.
I wish that, just kind of maybe sum up, I wish that these processes could be more
mm-hmm.
win-win kinds of processes than win-lose. They tend to have the win-lose sense to them. Now, I think out of the consensus process, I saw more opportunity for win-win kind of situations, but it had to be the right issues, had to have the right people at that table, they had to have equivalent kinds of funding and information available to them. It wasn't exactly equal, but you know, they had to have equal weight, and you could see win-win situations in that. It was ironic that when they established environmental regulations for groundwater protection in the state of Wisconsin, now the environmental groups who were involved in that are being criticized by some of the environmental groups today for having compromised. But if you go back and look at that, you talk to the environmental people who were involved in that, they said, we had to know what was the standard upon which we could sue. We wanted to sue their butts, you know? And we had to know when they broke the law. So we had to say what the law was. And the mining companies were saying, we had to know what the rules were. How could we make a decision where to go ahead and mine if we didn't know what we had to design to? And so they had, from totally different viewpoints, came to the same point that they had to agree on a groundwater protection law. And it's just interesting that what we see today that there are some groups are criticizing the environmental groups for having participated in that process, saying, well, you just facilitated mining. You just made it easier for them to go ahead. As if the key is to keep them so off balance that they never know what the rules are or whatever it is, or just simply to just say no. Yeah. And that's one thing our process doesn't allow for very often, is to just say no. And that's something that which I think we have to think about sometimes too. But our process is not designed to do that. It's designed to kind of work out issues, work out conflicts. It's not very often that we work out a conflict by prohibiting something, absolutely prohibiting. One more comment.
Okay, not a comment, a question. The consensus process as defined in your state, does it allow for something similar to a federal labor negotiator that you get in negotiations or for a mediation process?
Yes, it can. It can do that. And it kind of depends on whether or not the process kind of really needs that person to keep everybody feet under the table, or with the, you know, keep everybody there and
their
keep
hands
working.
On the table for,
yeah,
for
keep
the less strong groups, it would seem it would almost be. In other words, like the Native Americans or the you know, naive homeowners that he was talking about.
Yeah.
They can do a lot for that.
So mediators are can often be an important part of this. In fact, when we did our groundwater law in Wisconsin, done through consensus, it was facilitated by a mediator, kind of informally done. Didn't have official sanction, but it was the people who were in that process realized they needed to have somebody there to help them. What you need sometimes is somebody to remind you what you're agreeing on. Because you can get so caught up in your disagreements, you forget that you have a reached agreement on certain things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes a mediator can really do that. And remember, we agreed on this particular point. Can we build from that instead of always being on opposite sides?